Robin Miller, welcome to another edition of the Week in IndyCar News. We are coming out of the duel in Detroit, one that our boy Graham Rahal, your longest tenured PR client, came away with two big wins. I don't want to say career-defining wins, but it sure looked like he really came into his own, I think. You said it as well, but man, that kid was just in a place, in a real zone around Detroit, at a place where there's some corners that if you push too hard, you can hurt yourself. That kid, absolutely fearless, 2 days in a row, kicked everybody's butt. What did you think about your number one client?
Well, I haven't been paid in several years, but he's, you know, Dario used to say, how much does he pay you? Come on. I always was impressed with the kid when he was 19 years old, driving a champ car, had no idea what he was doing, and Sebastian Bourdais did not destroy him mentally, or, you know, Bourdais beat him, but the kid didn't get destroyed. And then when Newman Haas, you know, when they moved on and he was making the fast six on the last 30 seconds every race at the age of 20, I mean, you can't teach those things. You either got them or you don't. And yeah, of course, he went through a dry spell and jumped around teams and stuff, but he's always had the talent, and I think, you know, this is the third straight year he's shown it. But I think it almost might have been more a defining moment for that team. And you know their personnel and their engineers better than I do. But that was a Scott Dixon willpower ass kicking. And that didn't happen very often to mere mortals. So I think, talking to Bob Rahal after the race, just that, you know, he finally has an engineering staff set in place for 3 years, and he always got along with Martin Pare at Newman Haas, and Eddie Jones has been good, and Mike Talbot's been good, and there's one more that I never can remember. Help me out. There's four of them. Oh, Tom German from Penske.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Tom German, new addition.
So those four guys for a one-car team, and I think Servia probably helped at Indy when Graham went from last to. I mean, he was legitimately went from last to third, and then he took over the lead for a couple laps during pit stops. But, you know, they've been running good probably from the last two races on, and that's what you get. You get confidence and get on a roll. That's what racing's all about, and I think that's what he didn't have for several years, and I think that's what Marco lacks right now. He needs the same kind of, you know, if you have a race in, you have a weekend like that, brother, it's – I mean, I don't know how you can't put it into words or financially what it's worth, but mentally what it's worth to the team and to you. The reason I picked him last week on our podcast is because he's run second, third, and fourth. He's always run good there, so it's not like he hadn't run well there. It's just that I don't think anybody saw that coming.
Well, I think what Bob Rahal told you was one of the most important things, and that, yeah, if you do think about it, Graham has had Eddie Jones as his main man, so now when they're going back to tracks for the third time together, especially with this aero kit that they've obviously figured out with the full might of their engineering team, you have that confidence, right? You look at Will Power and Dave Faustino, so many years together, and granted, if anything, I think Will might actually be the bigger variable in that relationship, because, you know, we almost don't know what willpower we're going to get from weekend to weekend, but you know that Faustino is a pretty rock solid guy. You look at Dixon and you look at his engineer Chris Simmons, those are probably the two most rock steady in the paddock if we look at driver and engineering combinations. So just cool, as Bob pointed out and as you wrote, Graham, now that he has that and has gotten to that place, still hard for them as a one-car team, but you can see this growing and building into something where, you know, a couple of really good championship finishes in a row. You know, Graham's at a place where I think he can turn himself into an even bigger threat. And we already look at the guy as someone who's top five championship material, and, you know, a threat almost everywhere we go. So I just thought it was a really cool weekend. And as you wrote, seeing a guy kind of come into his prime, still young, but come into his prime, you don't get to witness that so often. You look back at what Dixon did, though, and, you know, not taking away anything from Graham, but you look at Dixon, who hurts himself at Indy, loses any real chance for capturing proper points, finishing 32nd in a double points event. And this guy leaves Detroit in the championship lead, Robin. I mean, an amazing drive on Saturday to finish second, salvage to sixth on Sunday in the second round. But I still, brother, going into St. Pete, you and I certainly were saying, oh yeah, Scott Dixon, he's going to be the championship leader at the halfway point. I mean, what did you see last weekend that just made you shake your head and go, how does this guy do it?
Well, I mean, he's probably the best and has been for a long time. And, you know, over to drive hurt like he did, I mean, it had to be pretty painful, but he never complained. And, you know, him and Simmons, like you said, they're a good team. And they always seem like they whatever's out there, they get. If that was a second place, I don't think he had anything for Graham, but they got a second place out of it. And the next day, they salvaged sixth. So that's how you – what's amazing is there have been seven races, seven different winners, and Dixon hadn't been one of them, but he's leading the points. Castroneves hadn't been one of them, and he's second in the points, like you wrote yesterday. So it's been an interesting season, and anytime you have a – I mean – what other series has seven different winners in seven races? That's why it's fun to watch, because you never know what's going to happen.
We had Esteban Gutierrez come into the series last weekend at Detroit in some truly trying circumstances, and full marks to him for accepting it, right? No testing, nothing. he got a feel for the Dallard EW12 Honda Friday morning. Opening practice session, first laps in the car, first anything, never been in the car, never been to Detroit. The guy bit off a lot. What did you think about his performances throughout the weekend with his F1 pedigree and some of that stuff? Did you think we would see more from him? Or do you think he, you know, performed where he should, or were you underwhelmed?
Oh, no, the fact that he finished on the lead lap the second, I mean, going to a place like Detroit's a tough track to learn. You know, I mean, it takes two or three years for guys to really get comfortable on it. And what did he have? 45 minutes? He had two 45-minute practice sessions. So, I mean, yeah pretty damn impressive. And, you know, I think that with Craig Hampson and Mike Cannon, I mean, those guys are pretty steady and forward. They've always done well with rookies, always. And, you know, they obviously – they instilled some confidence in him, and the kid drove pretty damn good.
It was also nice to see Hinch have at least one good finish and have some things go positively for him after recovering from first lap spin on round or during the race one. Things were a little more eruptive on day two. One of his onboard transmissions was pretty funny. To paraphrase, it said, yeah, this wasn't an electrical malfunction, and his Honda let go in a fairly serious manner. And then Spencer Pigot lost a turbo soon after and fogged down the entire track. So, you know, we still haven't gotten away from some of the reliability issues that are plaguing Honda. Chevy hasn't blinked that often, and granted, this is more of a turbo issue than the Spencer's motor erupting, but couple extra variables in there too. We had a red flag on Sunday, and you know, if you are looking for entertainment, it seems to me that a lot of the fun little unexpected bits definitely should have kept you awake on Sunday.
Well, you think about this, it's you know, Graham would probably, we'd probably have the same reaction Graham would have had. Yeah, I'd like to see it end under the yellow, because it's racing, that's the way it goes. Those races, he made them so monotonous both days. They tried to get something going, and the real key was ABC had 45 minutes left to fill, and on Saturday they had 30, and they interviewed everybody but you and me because we weren't there. So, what are you going to do? Well, they went in the favor of let's try and give them a little drama at the end, and I think the way it turned out, you know, the right guy won the race, and everybody got at least the idea that maybe there was going to be something happen. The top five didn't change places at all at the end. I think Connor might have lost. I think he was a little miffed. I think he had two good races, but I think he might have got lost a couple spots on the restart. But, you know, the thing that's tough about that is the purist in us says, okay, those things happen. You blow up and the race ends under yellow. That's too bad, but that's racing. So when you do this, and when Bo Barfield did it at Fontana and at Indy, it kind of made sense. It was for the championship, and at Fontana, you know, there was 15 different guys led anyway, so that was, you know, nobody was really sure. And at Indy, it just set up another hellacious finish with Castroneves and Reinhardt Rey. So the fans appreciated it. And when you see the TV ratings, they were pretty dismal over the weekend, and Indy was a big disappointment. You got to figure, okay, how are we going to get people to watch this stuff? Because the racing, you can't ask for anything more. I mean, Indy had everything you'd ever want, but I haven't figured that one out yet.
Leaving Detroit, we know that thankfully, mercifully, very, very intelligent folks at IndyCar decided that, hey, young Mr. Gutierrez, it was great having you in Detroit, and we will hopefully see you at a road or street course in the future, but you sure as heck aren't going to learn how to drive on an oval at Texas. Tell me about that decision, Robin. We spoke about it last week and prayed that that was the direction IndyCar would go. We also had Tristan Vautier named, which you broke that story yesterday about stepping in.
Everybody has to have at least a test on an oval. I mean, Alonso had a test. So, I mean, you don't want to do that to the kid. You don't want to do that to Coyne's team, and you certainly don't want to do that to the competitors. So I think the most important thing is that, it looks like he'll be back at Elkhart Lake. And, you know, Texas has been repaved. It's got a new turn one and two, and there might be issues. You know, your story today, we'll talk about that in a minute, about Firestone and trying to make the right tire, and you got Honda engines exploding. I mean, it's probably the worst place to make your oval track debut, considering all the variables, but it's just not a good place to start your oval track. And, you know, Jay Fry and Brian Barnhart were pretty adamant. Look at the rule book. It ain't going to happen. And there wasn't enough time to test him, so maybe Iowa, something like that. Give him a day at testing in Iowa and let him run.
So thankfully, they avoided what would have been probably a big calamity for Gutierrez. Tell me about some other first-time oval debuting drivers that come to mind where either you were thinking, oh my God, how did they let that guy out? Or are there any that come to mind where you say, thank goodness they went in the same direction as Esteban and said, nope, not here, not now?
Well, you think about Steve Barclay. I think he got upside down at Indy on his first phase of his rookie test. And
yeah.
Dr. Harry Sauce, he pile drove it on his second or third phase, I think. Then you get to the IRL, and you got Tony Turco and Bronco Brad Murphy and Racing Gardner and Jack Miller and all these guys that had no business being in an IndyCar, and they're running ovals only. So, I mean, the IRL needed cars and drivers, so you pretty much didn't have to have too many qualifications. Whereas now, IndyCar's pretty much weeded out the wankers. There's a couple at Indy every year, but for the most part, it's a pretty solid field. And Vautier taking over, think about what he did in 2015 for Coyne's team at Indy. I mean, qualified for Davidson and then took over for Carlos Huertas. And, I mean, the kid did a really good job, and he's a former champion. I mean, he deserves a ride probably as much as anybody.
Well, granted, you and I are going to be disappointed because we aren't having a grumpy cat return with young Mr. Huertas, but love that kid. Would love to see him around. But yeah, I'm with you, and I don't think the choice of Vautier should be as big of a surprise as it seemed to have been for some folks. And that's because you look at someone like James Davison, who I think a lot of folks figured, all right, well, this kid just drove the wheels off the thing at Indianapolis, natural fit to put in the car for this next, you know, Speedway Oval. I don't disagree. I mean, that kid is the hardest of hard chargers, and I love him for that fact. But there's a certain danger that exists at Texas that doesn't at Indy. And I think we might have mentioned this last week. There are a few drivers who are less popular than James Davison among the other IndyCar drivers, especially after Indy and just in his limited outings. He hasn't made a lot of friends because the kid goes for every gap, whether they exist or not, doesn't give an inch. Doesn't know that he has mirrors. I mean, everything he does is about going forward, balls out, 1,000%. Yeah, we love that. It's the same kind of thing that we praise in a Sage Karam and some of the others, you know, other young chargers. But I think IndyCar also heard from enough people after Indy, and it's not as if they can tell Dale Coyne who he can or can't put in his car, but I wouldn't be surprised if IndyCar said, why don't you look somewhere other than Davison for Texas, and Vautier, who's also really fast, also a really hard charger, but has also proven to drive with a little bit greater sense of community and community welfare. I don't have an issue with that pick at all, and I actually think with his past coin experience, in theory, he should be able to fit right in pretty easily.
No doubt about it. And you know, when he jumped in for Grumpy Cat, he finished fourth at Detroit and I think sixth at Mid-Ohio. He had a couple of really good races.
Big shocking news this week, Robin. And, you know, we've been sitting on this exclusive for a long time. Unfortunately, we got beaten to it, but we won't cry over that too much. Dallara chosen to build 2018 IndyCar bodywork. The big news is out. Woo!
It's not like there's a big line of people wanting to do it because, and the other thing is, I mean, I'm just kind of surprised it took so long to announce it because I think Dallara's been working on it for 6, 7, 8 months. I mean, they're pretty far down the road. So this didn't happen over this week. Hey, we're going to let these guys build it. No, I mean, they're way down the road. So, and you know what? It's a racy car. It's a safe car. They've done a good job. So more power to them.
So with all that said, we move into Texas this weekend and IndyCar always has variables. It's become the, for me at least, probably the most fun part of this season. Just, you know, this guy rises for a race or two, then falls out of nowhere. This other person jumps up out of nowhere. I mean, even Max Chilton, who, you know, unfortunately we don't feel his presence on a very regular basis, but he jumped up during the month of May. You wrote a really nice story about, hey, wow, this kid's charging. Put in his, what he felt was his best performance to date at the Grand Prix of Indy, and then backed it up by doing even better at the Indy 500. Cool, coming out of the month of May, you know, maybe we're going to see Chilton. Okay, was he at Detroit? I don't know. I didn't even notice him. I mean, we saw him, obviously, but he went from being everywhere to nowhere in a span of one event, and that's been kind of the name of the game this year so far. You look at Ryan Hunter-Reay, fourth at St. Pete to open the season, and other than a modestly okay finish at the GP of Indy, everything else has just been heartbreak, explosions, leaky motors, etc. You look at Dixon coming out of nowhere. I mean, it's just been this weird season of folks rising and falling. Then we get to Texas, where the test there in April with the new track surface that admittedly has impressed absolutely no one that I know of in IndyCar. You probably read some quotes where folks said, oh, it's great, it's wonderful. And then you talk to them outside of a press release and they go, yeah, this is not as good as we had hoped. And found some tire match issues. The Firestone tires that Firestone tested there really did not jive all that well with the track surface. And I guess a really quick an important point of clarification, this isn't a case of Firestone making bad tires or bringing the wrong tires. It's why you go to a track that's been resurfaced to test and find out what that surface gives you. I think they expected one thing, found another, and then had to go back and make some fairly significant changes, come up with new tires that they're going to roll out for the Friday-Saturday event this weekend, Robin. And that means, yet again, using the word variable once more, teams aren't going to show up with a known tire and a known setup and just plug in and start lapping right away and sharpen and perfect their cars to go for the pole and get ready for the race. They're going to have to spend a fair amount of time learning the tires. And some will do a better job than others, which could cause some teams that we wouldn't expect to rise and maybe some who might get it wrong to fall. So I love it. I mean, as storytellers, we're looking at a race that at least right now should be anything but predictable.
I mean, they've been flat out for a couple months building tires for this race. They're going to bring in 1,100 tires, and they're bringing a backup set. That's what I was told. So, I mean, you got Firestone's. They charge a lot of money for tires, probably too much, but their tires are damn good, and their commitment's damn good. So. Last year, if you could just have the tire degradation like last year, then you have this phenomenal, God, what was it, 3 or 4 cars at the end? It's everything that oval fans love. So hopefully it'll, by the time we get to, I mean, the first practice sessions, I think it's 10 a.m. to 1 o'clock, which, you know, I mean, you're going to qualify later, and then you're going to race at night. So I don't know. how you figure that out, but it'll be a challenge, no doubt about it.
All right, so last item for the week. Robin, you're always in close contact with the heroes and legends of the sport. Also have your team lunch. Share some fun stories, tales, or lies from the last week of Robin Miller's life with IndyCar's greats and some of the lesser greats.
Not much to report because I haven't seen anybody, but Dan Gurney, today he texted me a picture in his Mount Rushmore sweatshirt with a big smile and his thumbs up. And I don't know, it's just cool to see that because he really thought they were cool. And we've had such an outpouring of people wanting to buy them, we may have to actually make some more. But I think, you know, AJ, Dan Gurney, Parnelli, and Mario, it's going to be tough to ever top that. We had to hide him from Bobby Unser during the month of May because we didn't want to lose him as a friend. He'd be suicidal. Why am I not on that shirt, honey? Who made that decision? So, you know, it's we'll see what happens this weekend. I think John Rutherford will be there and Anthony Joseph Voigt, but we won't see Parnelli or Gurney for a while, probably.
Well, let's tell Uncle Bobby for next year we're going to make some custom adult diapers with his face on the inside.
50-year anniversary of Unser's first Indy win, so that there's going to be a Bobby Unser day. We've already started planning that.
I also love the fact that you and our friend Steve Shunk had to go down to Gasoline Alley during the month of May when you were wanting to get you know, the Mount Rushmore folks to sign some prints and some other things. I also love the fact that you had to go see AJ first to get his signature first because you knew there'd be some problems.
AJ always has to sign first, buddy.
Yeah. If Mario's name was on there first, there were going to be problems.
Yeah. And the other thing I told Dan today on my text, I said, notice whose head's biggest in the picture, and he laughed because we had to make AJ's head biggest because he's from Texas, damn it.
I love it. All right, Robin. Well, Texas is almost here. We'll have some more fun stuff to talk about next week, and thanks to everyone for checking in for the week in IndyCar News.